Okay, welcome everybody. This is the office hours session for week 6 of the Mises Academy online class, Anatomy of the Fed. And today is August 4th, 2012. So we've got a few people already in the room. As always on these things, if you have questions, go ahead and start typing them just right in the chat box. Since I don't see any pending ones right now, let me deal with the good questions that Robin emailed me that's very pertinent to the material in this class. And as always, as I'm talking, if stuff occurs, you go ahead and type it in because that will affect how long I blather on for this current question. Okay, so let me, and I'll even type this out so that others can see it when I, when we archive this, that you can see that in the chat box. So let's put it in caps to make it easy for people to see. So Robin asked, are bad loans deflationary? Okay, so that's a good question. So what Robin means, and I just saw it in a subject line, he may have elaborated more in the email, but what he was getting at is, and you hear this claim a lot, that people say, oh, in the present environment with all these bad loans that are on the bank's books, hey, buddy. Can you go in the other room, please? Or be real quiet?
My computer didn't work.
Okay, well, just reboot it. You know what I mean? Turn it off and turn it back on. Okay?
It's too frozen. You know what I
mean? All right, we'll pull the power, the cord out. And put it back. All right, we'll try again. Sorry. Computer issues. Okay. So what you hear people say a lot is that there's all these banks have made all these bad loans, and we have to wait. And as those loans fail, that's deflationary, it destroys money. And so that's why we haven't seen prices go to the roof. But yeah, Bernanke's pumping on the one end, but then you've got to have all this, like, all these deflationary pressures building up from the other end because of all these bad loans. Okay, so that you see things claims that are made like that. There is an element of truth in that sort of analysis, but I think a lot of the people who say it, I think they're putting their finger on the wrong part. Okay, so in other words, I think there is a sense in which it's true that a bunch of bad commercial loans, other things equal, will lead to, not other things equal, because other things won't be equal. There's a sense in which you could say a bunch of bad loans will have deflationary pressure, but it's not, I think, for the reason that the people who say that believe. All right, so let me just walk you through that. I think it's easiest to not think about electronic deposits. Think of it in terms of gold and paper plane tickets. Right, so you've got a bunch of bankers, and we have an economy that just has true gold, commodity gold is the money, and so people, take them to the mints and they hammer them into coins, and that's what the base actual money is, money in the narrower sense, as Mises would say. But then you have a fractional reserve banking system, and so people will go and deposit their gold coins with the banks, and they'll get a bunch of paper tickets. Say the bearer of this note can go to any of our branches and get 1 ounce of actual metal gold, okay, that stuff. But the bankers make loans over and above what has been put on deposit with them. So at any given time, there's more of those pieces of paper that are immediately redeemable, and the public is assured of their safety, these notes circulating in the community. So there's more total notes out there than there is physical metal gold in the vaults. Okay, no central bank. Let's keep things real simple. So that's the sense in which fractional reserve banking can increase the total quantity of money in the broader sense, right? If you say that money includes not just the actual metal, but also these notes that everybody accepts at par as if it were the same thing as a genuine physical ounce of gold. Okay, so now in that environment, what happens if a particular bank all of a sudden discovers, oh my gosh, we have on our books all these assets, because we made these loans to various business people, and on our books it says these IOUs are worth a billion ounces of gold because we have these loans out to whatever, a million different borrowers. On average, each of them owes us 1,000 ounces of gold. And now, because the economy is awful, we're entering into this bad recession, a lot of these businesses are failing, and they're calling us up and saying, sorry, we can't pay you back. I know I signed this promissory note that a year ago you gave me a bunch of those pieces of paper that were that entitled someone to go to your branch office and get a physical metal ounce of gold. And I took those notes and I used them. I went out and I signed a piece of paper at the time saying, you're giving me 1,000 of these pieces of paper, and next year I promise to give you 1,050 back. So I was borrowing 1,000 ounces of gold from you at 5% interest for 12 months. You answered that on your book as an IOU, as an asset. On my books, of course, as a businessman, that was a liability. I owed it to you. And then you transferred to me 1,000 pieces of paper that the community treats as equivalent to money, and so that was an asset on my books. It was a liability on your books. And then I went out and I hired workers and I bought materials and I did all this other stuff, paid the landlord for 3 months rent in advance, and so that money is gone. Those pieces of paper you gave me, they're gone, and now no customers are showing up at my office, so I have to shut down. And let's just assume I have no money when all is said and done. I can give you absolutely nothing. So that IOU on your books that says I'm supposed to give you 1,050 ounces of pieces of paper that are claims that your own bank issued, I can't do that now. All right. So I think a lot of people believe – so now what does the commercial bank have to do? They have to say, oh, are you kidding me? And the person has no assets. All right. So it's not like they can go after his house or something, even if that were part of the contract, all right? So it's a total bust. So now what happens, the commercial bank, on its asset side, there was an IOU there that they thought at this point should just be about worth 1,050 ounces, right? Because when they first made the loan, they entered it on the asset side as 1,000 ounces. But now as that 12-month date gets closer and closer, as time is passing, and they get closer to now the redemption date when the guy should have given them 1,050, the market value of that bond rises until it would normally just reach 1,050 on the day of payoff. Just to be clear, I'm assuming the guy wasn't making interest payments. I was assuming it was just a no-coupon bond, if you know what that means. They give him 1,000 up front. He goes a whole year without making any payments, and then after 12 months, he gives them 1,050 back. I'm just assuming that's the mechanics of how this loan is supposed to work. Okay, so what do they do now that he calls and says, sorry, I just don't have it. I got nothing for you. And he never will, right? It's not like they're going to say, well, maybe 3 years from now, he'll come back and pay us 200 or something. It's just assume they think this guy's never given us a dime. So on their books now, they just have to cross that thing off. That's no longer an asset. Its market value has gone down to zero, the IOU from that guy. So on their asset side, the total has now gone down by 1,050 ounces of gold. So in terms of double entry bookkeeping, something on the right-hand side has to go down by 1,050. So here is where I think people make their mistake. I think a lot of people who talk about the deflationary pressures coming from bad loans believe that now that money somehow disappeared from the economy, that now there's 1,050 fewer claim tickets circulating. But that's not true. The people who are currently holding those pieces of paper issued by the bank that say the bearer of this note can go to any of our branches and turn it in and get 1 ounce of actual gold upon demand, those are still out in the community, right? So the business owner who failed, it's not like he took the loan from the bank, they gave him 1,000 of those pieces of paper, and he burned them. That's not why he can't pay them back. The reason he can't pay them back is because he bought stuff with it, and it turned out that the stuff he bought now cannot convince other people in the community to voluntarily give him some of those plane tickets back. So he spent the money, and now he can't convince others voluntarily to spend money on what he made with it. So, but those 1,000 claim tickets are still out there. The, you know, the workers got them, and maybe they put them under their mattress, or maybe they went to the local saloon and got drunk with them, and now the saloon owner has them. But the point is, people still hold those pieces of paper. They have not been destroyed just because that one business defaulted on its loan from the bank. So from the commercial bank's perspective, those 1,000 notes that you can imagine it printed up out of thin air and handed to the guy 12 months ago, they're still out there. So those are still liabilities on the bank's books. So what the way you balance the assets and or the left hand and the right hand is the bank's equity gets marked down by 1,050. So the shareholders now, the capital they have in the bank, so to speak, just went down by 1,050 ounces. Assuming this was a complete shock to them. I mean, in the real world, they would see this coming, and along the way, they would have marked down the asset accordingly, right? So like 6 months ago, as the economy started to get bad, they might have said, you know, we probably should stop valuing this IOU from this business owner at face value because there's now a better chance that he's going to default than we thought 6 months ago when we issued this loan. So, I mean, if they were being smart, they would do that, but assume the recession totally took everybody by surprise, or assume that there was a huge earthquake yesterday, and that's why now all these businesses are failing. You want to make up some contrived scenario to keep the math simpler. All right, so if they were just totally shocked, they were sure the guy was going to pay him the full 1,050 today, and he calls them up at 9 a.m. when the bank opens and says, sorry, I got nothing, and you're never going to see a dime from me. The way they would respond to that in terms of the accounting is on the left-hand side on their asset side, that IOU that today should have just reached its full market value of 1,050 goes down to zero. And then on the right-hand side, because you know, the left and right-hand sides of the bookkeeping has to balance, they would mark down their equity by 1,050. Their liabilities would be unaffected by that. So the bank owes people money. And one big component of that is that they have these notes floating around that say the bearer of this note can go to any of our branches and get 1 ounce of gold. None of that changes. The fact that this business owner was supposed to pay him and now can't, that doesn't affect anything in terms of what the bank owes to the rest of the community. So another thing that might be confusing to people is, think of it this way. The business owner who was supposed to give them 1,050 ounces, he wasn't going to be able to create that money out of thin air. Right, so don't think of it as, oh, there was 1,050 ounces of money that was somehow going to come into the economy from somewhere, and now it's not, so therefore the economy has 1,050 ounces less. That's not the way to think about it. The business owner can't create money. For him to get that money to pay the bank, he would have had to produce real goods and services and gotten other people in the community to voluntarily give him some of their money, and then he would have given that money back to the bank. So that just would have been a transfer of already existing money in the total quantity of money from some people's pockets into the business owner's pockets and then to the bank. So the fact that he's defaulting on that loan just changes like the flow of that given stock of dollars or notes as they move around the community. It doesn't change the total quantity of how many notes there are. Okay, so that's the sense in which I could argue from a certain point of view that bad loans have absolutely no effect on the quantity of money at all. And I could just stop there, and I think everything I said would be correct. However, it's a little bit of a only a partial analysis, because if you push it, what could be true is to say now that bank, because it had to mark down its capital 1,050 ounces, is now more leveraged than otherwise would have been. So what normally would have happened if somebody pays off a loan, they would then turn around and make the loan to somebody else. Okay, but now if somebody else in the community pays off a loan, you know, so the banks, of course, had all kinds of loans on their books, all kinds of IOUs, all kinds of people owed them money. So now, because that first person totally defaulted, like we just talked about for 5 minutes, let's suppose the next person comes in and he does pay off the bank. Maybe he borrowed $500 last year, and now he owes them $525. And suppose he comes in and gives them 525 pieces of paper. Let's say the bearer of this note gets 1 ounce of gold from the bank. So he gives them 525 of those notes, and he says, "Okay, I'm done, right?" And they go, "Yep, thank you." So on the bank's books now, it crosses out the IOU from that guy. And there's two ways of thinking about it. Either you can have them on their own books list their own notes, or you can just have them destroy those notes, and then on their liability side, they reduce their liabilities by 525 ounces because there were there are now 525 fewer of those pieces of paper floating around the community. Okay, so that's probably the way they would do it. So if they do that, now that person pays the loan off, that does extinguish money. And so now here's the crucial part. Normally, if things were healthy, they would have then just relent that money out for what they might have actually done is kept the 25 ounces of interest and paid it to themselves and only destroyed the 500 that was actually the original loan. And then they would just relent the 500 out to somebody else. But now, because that other guy defaulted, they're more capital constrained, and their, you know, their leverage is higher than it otherwise would have been, right? So their total liabilities compared to their total capital is now a bigger number than it used to be. And so now they might be afraid, and they might say, whoa, let's be a little bit careful here. Because all these people are defaulting, as other people, good customers, pay off their loans, let's not relend that money out. Let's just destroy those notes so we shrink how many total of our notes are out there in the community. Because now we have a much smaller capital base to support all these outstanding liabilities. And our, you know, we're much more leveraged now than we thought we would be. And so now we're a little bit nervous. Okay, so that would be the mechanism through which you could say an environment in which all of a sudden banks realize they have a bunch of bad loans on their books would cause the quantity of money to shrink. It's not that the bad loan affects the quantity of money. But rather, it's when people pay off their loans that it shrinks the money stock. And now, if the banks are nervous because they have all those other bad loans, which in and of themselves do nothing to the money stock, now maybe they're reticent to roll those loans over. And so that is what could lead to a shrinking quantity of money in a broader sense. All right, so I probably spent too long answering that question, but it's a subtle difference, but I spent a lot of time on that because I want you guys to really think through and understand how it is, the connection between loans and the quantity of money, and that the way the quantity of money shrinks is not when someone defaults. It's the opposite. When someone pays back the bank, that's how the quantity of money shrinks, because remember, the banks are creating money out of thin air under a fractional reserve system when they make loans. So the way that that money gets destroyed, it doesn't matter if somebody owed money to the bank and now doesn't pay them. The way money gets destroyed is if people now pay money back to the bank. Because that's the opposite of a bank making a loan is not someone defaulting. The opposite of a bank making a loan is someone paying back a loan. Maybe that helps. Let me just say that one more time. The quantity of money expands when the banks make loans to people in the community that are not fully backed up by gold and vault. So clearly, how does the quantity of money shrink? What's the opposite of that process? It's when people in the community pay off those loans. That's the opposite of making the loan, is when people pay them back. If people just default, that's not the opposite of a bank pushing money into the community. That money's still out there if people default. The way you unwind it is if people pay the money back into the banks, and then if the banks just hold it, that's the same as if the money no longer exists. Okay, so now you guys have got some questions up here. George Smith says, if you were president, what would you do to fix the economy? Would you abolish the Fed? Okay, well, the popular glib answer when somebody says, hey, what would you do if you were the president, or what would you do if you were the chairman of the Fed, or whatever, or you were in charge of the IRS, what would you do, Murphy? The correct answer, of course, is to say, I would resign, right? And that's, you know, gets a bunch of cheers from the hardcore anarchists. And to be honest with you, I kind of think that is the right answer. In other words, that's not just being glib or cheeky or something. I really do think if you're asking, and even in all things considered, that even if I were the president, so don't worry, I'm not going to dodge your question. I will tell you in a minute all kinds of things that they could do that would be better than what they're doing now, because that's what you mean. But I am making this point, since you bring up the question, that with my worldview and everything as it is, I really do think the most good I could do, if aliens came and somehow made me, you know, they said, okay, we want this guy Murphy to be the president, or else we're going to blow everybody up. And so I was like, okay, I guess this guy Murphy's president. Let's hope he's not a nut job. I really think the best thing I could do for humanity, my lasting legacy, would be to get up, have a press conference, and everyone around the world is like, oh, my gosh, what is this guy going to do, this crazy, bald Irishman, with these aliens now forced to be the president of the United States? Oh, man, I hope he doesn't start World War III. And then people would start looking at my blog and be like, oh, my gosh, he's going to put us on the gold standard. Oh, we're all going to die. I think what I would do is get up and say there should be no such person with this kind of power. No matter how much I think I'm smart and I can do what's good, there will always be mistakes. There will always be information I don't have. There will be unintended consequences. Even if I did something that would be good if it were imposed voluntarily, I know you people didn't want me to be your president. I'm only president because of the aliens. That's not the way to do things. That's not the way to make the world a better place. So I resign. That's my only action. And I encourage any successor who is pushed here by the aliens to do the same thing. Thank you, everybody. And I'd walk off. And I actually think that would be the most utilitarian, the most pragmatic thing I could do, as well as according with, you know, my view of natural law or whatever. Right? But that's not fun. You want to know if the question is, you know, are they, Ron Paul becomes president, and then he calls me on the phone and just says, hey, I'm not resigning, I'm going to do some stuff. So you want me to do things that make more sense than things that make less sense, so what kind of stuff should I do, Bob? Okay, first of all, I think they should massively cut federal spending, like by $2 trillion. And they should just get rid of the income tax. I don't mean cut it. I don't mean make it a flat tax. I mean they should literally just get rid of the income tax and then have it on press, you know, on national TV, get all the employees and all the computers and everything out of there, and then blow up the IRS, like literally have detonation charges and bring the thing down. And then just to, you know, to show people, not only are we lowering your taxes right now, but this is done. The IRS is done. And because that would matter too. It's not just a matter of having people think their taxes are going to be lower for the next few years. You really want them to think, for as far as the eye can see, we're not having an income tax anymore. And if you did that, I mean, I can't even imagine the explosion in economic activity that would occur. Explosion in a good sense, not, I mean, it kind of would blow up. I mean, I've made jokes to people, because I'm a consultant at this point, so there's tons of work that I have. It's not like I just do a job for a salary and I get a certain paycheck every month. I get paid by doing one-off projects for a bunch of different clients. So my income in any given period is partly a reflection of how much I work. That, you know, if I really need more cash for something, I can just work more. Like, I can go try to get more jobs and work on weekends and that kind of stuff. So I've, you know, joked to people when talking about tax reform and things. I said, if if the IRS announced that for some reason next month any income you earn would be tax-free, I said I would go and get a bunch of cocaine and just not sleep that whole month. I would just work the entire 30 days and try to pull forward as much of my income as possible and get it in that month so that I'm not paying whatever it is, 35% to the government. So if you extrapolate that, and if people thought that there wasn't going to be any income tax for the next several years, then there would be a heck of a lot more work. And people don't understand that if you just have a regular job, like if you work in a factory and you go in and you punch a clock and you work your 8 hours or 8.5 hours counting lunch, and you punch out and you get your paycheck, and then at the end of the month you see, or every 2 weeks whenever you get paid, you look and see, oh, they took out this much from FICA and this much went to federal withholding because of how many deductions I claimed and blah, 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 and here's my net check. And whether or not they changed how much they withheld from your check, people who think like that would say, well, what could I do? I can't work more. The boss wouldn't let me work overtime. So how would a tax cut make me produce more? I would still go to work the same amount. But if you own your own business, then you totally see how tax rates affect your behavior and how your total output would drastically change. So that's one thing I would do. And then people would say, well, wait a minute, but if you got rid of the income tax, total revenues would go way down, and so there would be this huge deficit. Well, other tax revenues would increase, and in the meantime, to bridge that gap while you waited for the economy, because I think the economy would grow at, like, I don't know, at least 10% a year for a few years. And that's considering the fact that there'd be a massive drop in GDP from the government spending going down. Like, there'd be a transition period for, let's say, 6 months. But then after that, it would just be phenomenal, sustainable growth. So I'm saying, even just getting rid of the income tax, the other taxes, if you still left them on the books, would eventually, their tax bases would grow so much that you'd have more revenue coming in than before after some lag. And so to get over that hump where all the, you know, at day one, revenues to the federal government went way down, and maybe we didn't cut spending enough to totally counteract that, so there's this other things equal that would make higher deficits. I think the way you handle that is there's all kinds of assets the federal government could sell off. And I've talked about that at Econ Lib. I had an article about, I don't know, 8 months ago or so, just detailing, and I came up with, I'm making this number up, I want to say I came up with $500 billion of assets that the federal government could easily raise, like, in a month. I mean, they own a bunch of, well, they claim they own a bunch of gold, maybe they don't. They claim, you know, they have a strategic petroleum reserve, oil reserves, they have a ton of land. There are certain states where the majority owner of the real estate is the federal government. They're, you know, out in the West where not too many people live, right? So there's all kinds of, like, offshore minerals and things that the government right now leases to companies that if they really needed cash, they could just outright sell that stuff to the private sector so that companies would own the land that's under the ocean, that's 2 miles offshore or something in the Gulf, and on all the oil and everything that's underneath it. So they could easily raise trillions of dollars over the course of a few years just selling off stuff that right now the federal government owns. And so that would help make that transition. Okay, so as far as the Fed and then the monetary system, I really like Mises' idea of he wanted to get to 100% reserves backed up by gold, but he understood it would be tricky to try to do that at day one. And so what he did in the Theory of Money and Credit in the later editions contained an essay that he wrote, I want to say in 1953, around then, I mean, don't quote me on the date, but it's roughly in that period, where he had a really good idea for how do you reconcile all those things. And I think I had a Mises.org article on this called something like Putting the Country Back on Gold, something like that. And it, so the, because here's the problem. I realize I'm kind of rambling here, but there's, I'm trying to figure out the best order to tell you these things. So if we know, if we understand the problem with fractional reserve banking, and we know that that has the power to create boom-bust cycles, and I'm speaking like that because there are people, free banking Austrians who say it's only government-influenced fractional reserve banking, that market fractional reserve banking would be fine. I don't want to take a stand on that right now. I don't want to be controversial. So my point is fractional reserve banking has the power to cause these things, these boom-bust cycles, and, of course, inflation. So if you want to stop that, one easy way would be to say, let's have 100% backed money, including what the commercial banks do, and have it be gold. So how would you get to that if you just said right now, okay, today is Monday, and we have all these dollars floating around the world that are not backed up by gold. So tomorrow on Tuesday, we want to have all the dollars backed up by gold. It's a little bit problematic because then you got to worry about, well, what price do we set? Do we just take the total quantity of gold that's in the vaults right now and figure out how many dollars there are divided by the number of gold ounces that we have, and that's the number that we're going to now lock in as the gold price? Because that could be a really big number. That might be higher than the current market price of gold. Right? So I don't know what the numbers are, but let's say you ran that figure, and right now for every, especially if it turns out that the government really doesn't have that much gold in Fort Knox. If it, you know, because there's, I'm sure many of you know, there are people who suggest that actually the government is really actively manipulating the gold market. And the way they do it is they take gold that's supposed to be in Fort Knox, and they go and they lease it to like hedge funds who then short the gold market. You know, they sell into it and push down the gold price. So like if Bernanke comes out and announces QE7, and normally that might make the gold price shoot way up, the people in power don't want that because that's kind of a slap in the face. And so they will, behind closed doors, take, whatever, 1,000 pounds of gold out of Fort Knox, lease it to some hedge funds who are in on the joke, and then they go and sell that into the markets. And so normally the gold price starts to go up because of QE7, but then they see there's all this massive selling, and it pushes it down. And so it, and so then, you know, the Austrians and the gold bugs and the libertarians who are complaining about inflation and stuff look like idiots. Goes, well, Bernanke announced QE7 and the gold price actually went down 1%. You guys are morons, right? So there are claims the government does stuff like that. So if that's true, maybe the government right now actually in the vault doesn't have much gold at all. So I'm saying it's possible if you look at how many total dollars there are, like if you calculated what's M1 or what's M2, and divided by how many ounces of gold the U.S. government and the Fed currently possess. It, again, I'm making this number out of thin air, but suppose it turned out that there's $30,000 for every ounce of gold that they had. And so if they wanted to instantly go back to 100% backed gold-backed dollar, they would have to announce, okay, from now on, if you turn in $30,000 in currency, we'll give you an ounce of physical gold. And so that wouldn't, you know, that's not a very reassuring thing to do. That might actually make the dollar collapse because everyone's thinking, oh, the dollar's not very strong. It takes 30,000 of them just to get 1 ounce of gold. That's not a very, you know, I could go to the markets right now and only turn in whatever it is, $1,700 and get 1 ounce of gold. So why would I give $30,000 to the U.S. government to get what I can get in the markets for only $1,700? That's stupid. Right? So that's the kind of issue you face. So anyway, what I liked about, but on the other hand, you know, so some people would say, and this is what Great Britain did after World War I, is they had printed up a bunch of pounds, and then they try to go back to the pre-war parity. So that would be like if the government just came along and said, okay, well, in 1971, with $35, you can get an ounce of gold. And so that's what we're going to do. From now on, if you come up to our doors and give us $35, we'll give you an ounce of gold. Because we want to go back to the prestige the U.S. had when it was back on a gold standard. So if they did that, that would be pretty crazy too. I mean, there would be a massive rush. Everybody around the world would be saying, holy cow, I can get an actual ounce of gold for $35 from the U.S. government. I'll take that deal. So all these dollars would be coming, and so then the government would have to, you know, so how would that work? They would have to quickly contract the money supply severely in order to shrink the outstanding number of dollars so that they could bring the market price of gold down to $35 an ounce from wherever it is right now, whatever, I don't know, $1,600, $1,700, something like that. So can you imagine how much deflation would be necessary so that the market price of gold is $35 an ounce to stop runs on the U.S. government? So that's kind of what Great Britain did, though not as exaggerated, after World War I. And that's why they were in such trouble in the 20s. All right, so that also seems like not a good idea. That would cause huge economic dislocation if they had to shrink the quantity of money that much and that quickly. Okay, so how do you deal with that? Then what do you do? So Mises, in that article that George Smith just posted there, the link to, he talks about what you say is, okay, boom, from this point going forward, he says, first you halt, the commercial banks can now only issue 100% backed loans, and the government, you know, same deal. So from this point forward, the gold will be backed up at a certain price, and you lock in the current market price. And I'm skipping a few of the details, but Mises has some thoughts about, well, what do you mean by market price? Like, just right now you go look at the markets and whatever that number is, or do you make an announcement and wait a couple months? So he has some thoughts about the actual mechanism. But the point is, loosely speaking, the price of gold that you lock in is the market price. Does that kind of make sense to us, right? That we don't want to be central planners. Why would we pick a number out of thin air? You should use the market price somehow. So he's saying, yeah, right now, boom, whatever the market price of gold is, you lock that in. So let's say it's $1,650. So okay, the U.S. government now says, okay, boom, from now on, forever, we will the market price of gold is $1,650, and we will maintain that because anybody who wants can come to our doors and give us 1,650 pieces of currency, and we'll give you an ounce of gold. Or if you give us an ounce of gold, we will print up 1,650 pieces of currency and give it to you. And that's all the government does going forward. So the Fed can't buy more assets. The Fed can't go buy treasury bonds and then create new money, new dollar bills that way. The only way the Fed or the Treasury can create new dollars going forward is if somebody goes up to the mint and gives them gold. And then they go and put the gold in the vault, and now they print up new dollar bills that are 100% backed by that new gold that's been added to the vault. So it's not that the whole system instantly turns into 100%, but rather from this point going forward, any new dollars that are created are backed up 100%. And so as the system evolves over time, more and more of the dollars on Earth are backed up 100%. So in terms of the whole system, it's drifting towards 100% gold backing. All right, so that's kind of a neat thing. So if you are going to have some sort of halfway measure where the government puts in place controls, that's kind of a neat thing that's not going to freak everybody out. So, and also too, I think they could just, like in terms of what would the Fed do, they could just let all the stuff on their books mature. and just unwind it that way. So they would just have a moratorium. They would stop buying new bonds. So I'm not saying they would just go dump it all on the market, because that would cause Great Depression the next day, I think. So a way they could try to back off of it is to just say, we're not buying anything more. And then as that stuff matured, you know, as the government made payments and those loans matured, they would just shrink on the Fed's assets, and then they wouldn't roll those loans over. And so their liabilities would shrink too, and the total quantity of money would shrink. So basically the bank reserves would go down. So that's still going to cause the banking system a lot of bank failures, but it might spread it out over time, so it's not as crippling as just if they dumped everything. On the other hand, if somebody says, no, don't do a controlled burn, just let's get the paint over with in 1 week and just totally shock the system, there's something to be said for that approach too. But that's, I mean, here we're being central planners here. Who knows what the right thing to do is. Okay, so yeah, George, ultimately you'd want to get rid of the Fed, for sure. And the question is just, do you do it in one day? I mean, like I say, if you could be sure that your policies would be in place for the next 4 years, maybe you would want to do a gradual winding down to avoid as much shock and terror as possible. But on the other hand, if you thought you might get overthrown, you might just want to get it over with really fast. So that's always the issue with these things. There's no right way to do it. Last thing, George, I had a big proposal in the book How Privatized Banking Really Works in the middle of that, where we talked about a transition period. And I brought these issues, and I used the analogy. I said, suppose you were back in the year 1850, and you and your brothers and sisters were growing up, and your dad owned a plantation with a bunch of slaves, and you and your siblings all, you know, had read abolitionist literature, and you knew slavery was morally wrong. Your dad dies, and now you guys inherit the plantation, and you technically own a bunch of human beings. What do you do? And so, of course, the moral thing is you can't continue with slavery. You have to end that immediately. It's not like you want to have slavery get phased out over time. But on the other hand, it is true that these people may have been, have grown up under the slave system, and it might be kind of heartless to just throw them out and say, okay, you're free, go ahead, and not like they don't know how to read. All they know how to do is, pick your dad's cotton and then get their food given to them and stuff and have someone build a house for them. Not a nice house, of course, but they might not know how to live independently. And so it might actually be kind of cruel to just throw them out in the streets and say, okay, you're free, we're great. And so I was saying probably what you and your siblings would do, probably the best approach to deal with those is to say to all the former slaves, okay, you are all free. We went to the court and we said, okay, the law says we're the owners of these people, but now we're going to engage in manumission where we give to them this property that we have, so now they all only own themselves. And so the law recognizes that. But now we're saying to you guys, the former slaves, if you want to go ahead. You're free to leave. But if you don't want to, you can stay here, and then let's come up with, some arrangements where we pay you wages, and because we feel so bad about what our dad did to you guys, we bring in tutors to teach you how to read and bring in somebody to, give you advice on how you manage a checkbook, or you get what I'm saying. So I think that's kind of the analogy for if all of a sudden I'm in charge of the Federal Reserve System, you clearly want to have options so if people don't want to use dollars anymore, they can start using all their currencies on day one. You don't want there to be any coercion remaining in the system. So if people want to opt out, you have to make it possible for them to do that. But on the other hand, the whole world right now is using dollars. And it's and there is this Federal Reserve System, and all these commercial banks are all tied into each other, and it does seem a little bit flippant to just say, nope, let's just shut it down tomorrow, and who cares if the whole world collapses? That, like, in a sense, the whole world has become dependent in their servitude to this system, and they don't know exactly on day one how to live free of the Federal Reserve System. And so, you know, maybe there is some analog of having a voluntary thing in place until alternatives that are totally from the market can rise up and people can flock to those. But if somebody wants to get out on day one, they should be able to leave. So it's like the analogy with those kids. You can't have guys with guns standing around the plantation keeping people on in the barracks saying, oh, no, we're going to train you and teach you how to live free before we let you let go. If somebody says, I'm out of here, you got to let him go because he's a free man now. So that's the kind of like the principle that I would try to use to reform the system where, you know, if some banks want to just totally opt out and not have any regulation from the Fed, they can do that. Okay. Dennis Foster says, Rothbard's idea that we just take the gold stock and divide it by the money stock and make that the exchange rate is interesting. Okay, well, in 11 minutes I'll be done. Okay, bye. Is it still a possible solution? What would happen if the government had already sold off all the gold stock? So, yeah, Dennis, I don't know at what point you wrote that question in my explanation there, but I think I already told you the problem with that. And I don't remember Rothbard's discussion. I mean, I read it, of course, at some point, but I don't remember. It's been a while since I've read that particular part of his ideas. At the very least, the problem is if it's such a high figure, it doesn't really constrain the government too much. Right? It's not a binding constraint. So if it turned out, again, just making numbers up, what if it turned out that with the total quantity of dollars right now compared to how much gold the government actually has, what if it works out that it's $30,000 per ounce? So if the Fed now all of a sudden says, hey, guys, we're going to be honest bankers again. This is hard money. From now on, the dollar is backed up 100% by gold at the exchange rate of $30,000 per ounce. I don't know that that would reassure markets. You know, it's true, it would put an upper limit. If you really thought the Fed were committed to that, then that they really would, come hell or high water, always be prepared to exchange gold for dollars at that rate, you know, okay. But keep in mind that under the classical gold standard, money was not backed up 100%, or paper currency was not backed up 100%. So that might be what's throwing some people. Under the classical gold standard, there was still fractional reserve banking, and even, my understanding is, even the government systems, like, so not just the commercial banks, but even the, you know, the government that was printing the central bank notes, even that was fractional reserve. Okay, so in other words, there could have been a run on the governments of the world, even under the classical gold standard that we think about as the golden age, no pun intended, the golden age of international commerce. Okay, so what the gold standard did was it constrained them. That if, you know, so back when it was the government, it was $20.67 an ounce roughly, you know, in 1925, let's say. So people knew the Federal Reserve, even though it could inflate. I mean, if you look at the Federal Reserve's monetary base and that kind of stuff, they did inflate. And that's what the Austrians say caused the 29 crash, was that there was this inflation in the late 20s. So the government was totally on the classical gold standard at that point. Great Britain was screwing around with it, and you could argue that that had something to do with it. But the point is the U.S. government was officially still on the classical gold standard even during the 20s when the Austrians say the Fed inflated and that's what caused the stock bubble and then the 29 crash. So clearly the Fed wasn't doing 100% gold-backed reserves at that point. Or sorry, 100% gold-backed dollar. But what is good about the gold standard, even just a non-fully backed gold standard is that as long as you think there would be serious embarrassment and investor ramifications from defaulting on that pledge or that peg, the government is going to be careful. They can't inflate too much because they know if they inflate too much, all that money is going to come back to them and people are going to want the gold, and then their gold stocks are going to get drained. So in that context then, the government announcing, oh, from now on, we promise if you ever turn in $30,000, we'll give you an ounce of gold, that's not a big deal. If the government came along and said, we promise from now on, we will always stand prepared to turn to give you gold in exchange for 2,000 U.S. dollars, that would be more interesting. And if investors really believe that, now you've just put an upper limit on the gold price. And so that would sort of lock in a floor for the value of the dollar, if you think of it that way. And so, I mean, that's what the point of the gold standard was. It was to convince investors that they could trust in the integrity of those national currencies. So people knew, I'm safe, you know, so if you're in Texas, you were comfortable investing in British stocks or British real estate because you knew if push came to shove, you know, your 100 shares in some British company, ultimately you could always just sell them for pounds and then turn the pounds in for gold. I think it's like 4.25 pounds per ounce. Right? So that was the whole point of having all these currencies linked to gold at various rates, was that investors around the world knew they always had an escape clause. They could always get out of it. They had assets that were denominated in that local currency. So, you know, if you invested in France, and if you invested in French bonds, they were denominated in francs. And so if you're in the United States, you don't want to get paid in francs. What the heck is that? What if the franc dollar exchange rate moves against you? But you knew it can't move against you on the classical gold standard because the franc is itself locked into gold at a certain ratio, and the dollar is locked to gold in a certain ratio. So there's a very narrow band for what the dollar and franc can do against each other, because if it moves too much, now there's an arbitrage going through gold with both the respective governments. Right, so that was the whole point of the classical gold standard. So now, if Bernanke announces, we promise we will always turn over an ounce of gold for $2,000 in U.S. currency, people, if they believed that, people around the world would say, oh, well, I'm going to invest that in U.S. assets. Because in dollar, you know, I'm happy buying bonds denominated in U.S. dollars because I know no matter what happens, I can always turn those things in for ounces of gold at the rate of $2,000 per ounce. But if Bernanke says we're just going to lock it in at $30,000, that doesn't mean too much for a long time. At some point it would be binding, but it doesn't mean much in the short term. Okay. Brad Skyle says, and we got about 5 minutes left, guys. Brad Skyle says, along with the bad loan, what do you say about the demographic argument? The biggest bubble in consumers are now savers and won't be spending like before. Brad, can you elaborate on that? I'm not sure exactly what you mean. And while you're doing that, Brad has a follow-up question. Do you think the Fed will do QE this month or before the election? Suppose the ECB comes up with $1 trillion in terms of U.S. dollars, QE this month, what pressure would that create for the U.S. Fed? Brad, I kind of think it's the other way around. I think if the ECB is inflating, that helps the Fed, because I think that juices stock markets, and so that makes people okay. It temporarily shores up the European debt markets for sovereign currency, because what the ECB would probably be doing is buying government bonds, or they would be buying stuff that then could be used to prop up government bonds. And the more they inflate, the stronger the dollar becomes, other things equal. So I don't because here's what I think is going to, the problem's going to be. At some point, they're going to, I think what they're trying to do, and I was just talking with somebody last night about this, somebody really freaked out about the economy. I think what they're trying to, I think they're going to try to just get through the election. So I think, yeah, they got all these problems that are festering, and they know the whole thing's going to blow up. And my guess is, not that I have a crystal ball or that I really think I understand what the master plan is, but my guess is, they want to get through this next election, not because it matters one way or the other. I mean, whether it's Romney or Obama, the bankers are still in charge. So it's not, I think it's just more, they don't like uncertainty, and they do have to go through this farce of the American people electing their government, blah, blah, blah. And so I think they kind of have to, let's just get through this, so then whatever, when the hammer drops, the American people will think, well, this is our duly elected representative. Is my guess. So I think they're kind of trying to hold off, because if there was like a catastrophe right before the election, that might taint things, and then people might not view whoever is in office as the legitimate power holder. So I think they really like this idea that the Americans selected their government, and okay, so anything we do to you now is just a reflection of your own choice, whereas that is a little bit hindered if there's a catastrophe right before the election, and the people whose guy didn't win, they might think, oh, it was only because it was manipulated. And I think they, since they control both candidates anyway, I don't see what benefit it is to them to have the election appear rigged. That go ahead and have an open election if both candidates are going to do what the bankers tell them to do. So I think the ECB is going to keep inflating and just try to keep that thing from totally collapsing until after the U.S. election. Then they're just going to say, okay, we'll let the thing collapse. The dollar is going to get temporarily stronger. And so the U.S. paradoxically might actually seem to be better for a couple months as Europe burns, perhaps literally, if people are rioting and stuff because the economy is so awful and their taxes get jacked up and the social programs get cut and all that stuff. And then at some point, people are going to realize, oh, wait a minute, the thing that happened to Europe is happening in the U.S. too. It's not that the dollar is immune from this stuff. It's the same system. It just it hit Europe first. So those are my pleasant thoughts. So I guess let me just, I don't know if Brad has tuned out at this point, but let me spend 2 minutes and then I'll let you guys go. Brad had asked earlier, with the bad loans, what about this argument of a demographic saying that now people are saving a lot more than they used to, and is that an issue? Well, in terms of standard Austrian theory, yeah, other things equal in the – oh, see the Q&A. Sorry, Brad, I didn't know that you would put it there. I see now, okay. Okay, so Brad, to clarify the question – would you apply your money contraction explanation to the demographic argument, which is the baby boom bubble is the most influential consumer group, and when the average baby boomer passed age 46, he changed from a spender to a saver? Well, that influences things a little bit in the sense from standard Austrian theory that the – Clark, hang on a second. That in the depression phase, what's the best thing that the public can do? It's actually to save more. So it's the exact opposite of Keynesian theory. Keynesian theory says, oh my gosh, in the downturn, aggregate demand has fallen, people need to spend. You know, it can be investment spending too. It doesn't need to be consumption spending, but the point is businesses are afraid to invest if the demand for their product is low. So in terms of you, the average consumer, what can you do to help the economy? You came in and say, well, go buy something, and then that will get businesses to start investing more, blah, blah, blah. Murray Rothbard says the exact opposite. Rothbard says, you know, you should, of course, do what your preferences tell you to do, but in terms of what would actually make, what would make the male investments of the boom period not be so bad is if people saved more. Because the problem of the boom period was businesses were starting projects for which there wasn't enough genuine savings to complete. Or another way of saying it is the interest rate got pushed lower as if there were more savings than there really were, and that misled people. So then, if you then ask, well, what could people do to mitigate that mistake? Well, if people actually did save more so that the true interest rate is closer to what the manipulated one was, well, then the mistakes wouldn't have been as bad. Maybe some projects that under the old savings rate would have been male investments now actually with the new savings rate are actually the right thing to do. So the entrepreneur didn't screw up. He got lucky. That, yeah, the Fed lowered the interest rates, or the commercial banks did, and that's what made them start it, but then the consumers actually changed their preferences and made it so that that was the right thing to do after all. Okay, so that's kind of the argument that Rothbard uses to say, you know, what could the public do to try to get through the depression and make the liquidation period as relatively quick and as painless as possible. They would save more, which is nice, because that's what people naturally do. In a depression, people's first instinct is we gotta cut back on discretionary consumption and save more. We gotta, you know, batten down the hatches. We gotta hunker down and get real austere. And so it's kind of neat from an Austrian perspective that what people are naturally led to do by the invisible hand is the right thing to do. Whereas Keynes can say it's the exact opposite. But, oh no. We can't have people doing what they want to do during a depression. So in that sense, Brad, it's true that the fact that people are saving more will mitigate the downturn, but I'm not sure, I mean, if you're asking, will that make the quantity of money be smaller than otherwise would? Well, in the sense, if what you mean is because now people are taking out fewer consumer loans, so it's harder for banks to inflate. That's kind of true. And I don't know in practice what the clearly the commercial banking system is not inflating as much as it could just looking at its excess reserves. And so then people have all kinds of different stories for why is it that the commercial banks aren't inflating and getting fully loaned up like the textbook says they should. And there's different reasons. So one is the capital constraints. They marked down on bad loans. So now, they have plenty of reserves. They have plenty of – they could expand loans and satisfy their reserve requirements, but not their capital requirements, either just internally or official regulations. And then another explanation is nobody wants new loans. So that kind of ties with what you're saying. So those are all related, and I don't know quantitatively which effect is stronger. But yeah, if people right now just don't want to take out new loans, even though interest rates are basically zero for some people, that would make it harder for the banks to expand the quantity of money. Okay, let me stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you on, Monday. So Monday will be a good one. We'll talk about unconventional Fed operations. So last week we talked about standard textbook stuff. Monday we're going to go over things like Operation Twist, quantitative easing, all this crazy stuff with these various discount windows and health and so forth.